This is John Sanford, January 26, 1991. What Every Jungian Should Know About Gnosticism. Tape 1 of 3.
I'd like to welcome you all here to John Sanford's presentation on Gnosticism this morning.
Thank you, Betty. Well, I certainly admire all of you for giving up a gorgeous day like this to come in here about a subject like Gnosticism. You're true, dedicated searchers after historical truth or something. Anyway, I appreciate the fact you're here and have invited me to come and be here with you. Incidentally, while my name is John, officially, and my books are John A. Sanford and so forth, I go by Jack. So if anybody wants to address me, they can call me Jack, and I feel more comfortable with that. Well, as all of us know who have been in the area of Jungian psychology, we hear a great deal from time to time about the subject of Gnosticism. In fact, in the last several years, it seems like there's been a resurgence of interest in Gnosticism. I noticed on the book table over there, there are about 4 books on Gnosticism I didn't know existed. I think they all appeared recently, like flowers popping up in the spring or something. So it's been a field that, if one reads and studies in Jungian psychology, sooner or later you come across many references to Gnosticism. In fact, it is sometimes argued that Jung derived much of his psychology from Gnosticism. Sometimes this statement that Jung derived much of his psychology from Gnosticism is made with appreciation, but sometimes it's also made in a derogatory way. That's one thing that Martin Buber, who was sort of an antagonist of Jung, you know, and they sparred a great deal in letters and things. And Martin Buber used to accuse Jung of being a Gnostic. And when he said that, it was not a compliment. So for some people, it's a compliment to say that Jung derives his psychology from Gnosticism. And for others, it's definitely the opposite. Jung himself has told us, as we will see a little later, that when he looked for historical antecedents to his psychology, that he found them in Gnosticism. But later on, as we will note, he decided that alchemy was really a much more fruitful source for the predecessors of his particular psychological approach. Now, historically speaking, Gnosticism has sort of been like waving a red flag in front of people. It has a history as a teaching of sparring with other theological or psychological points of view. Now, that's not remarkable. Everybody sparred with everybody else with their philosophical and theological and religious points of view. But nevertheless, it certainly was no exception. So when one mentions the subject of Gnosticism, even today, it's sort of like you have to choose up sides. It's like abortion, you know. You can't quite stand in the middle. Either you're for or you're against. And it takes a rare person who's able to look at the anti-abortion side and say, well, they have a point, and the abortion side and say, well, they have a point too. I mean, that's almost unheard of. You almost instantly line up on one side or the other. So Gnosticism as a study is a little bit like that. But we're going to try, at least I'm going to try this morning, to do the difficult and to present the idea of Gnosticism fairly and objectively, and simply looking at it for what it is, and then to compare the Gnostic viewpoint with the Jewish and Christian viewpoint, with which it was historically in a state of rivalry and antagonism, and then also to compare it to the point of view of Jungian psychology. And you all can be the judges whether I succeed in this endeavor or not. And in our discussion time, we will have plenty of time for your questions or points of discussion or refutations or whatever it is that you want to do. Now, I distributed or asked to have distributed these handouts, and they look like that. So I trust you all have these handouts, okay? The material is so complicated that it would have been very tedious to have attempted to diagram this material on a blackboard. And yet it would also be very, very difficult for people just to take notes of what I'm going to be saying. And so I asked that these handouts be made available, and I appreciate very much Carl Robinson for seeing to it that that was accomplished. So we can kind of, when the time comes, I'll indicate when things are on the diagram there that you've got, and you can kind of follow along. Now, recently, as I mentioned, there has been a resurgence of interest in Gnosticism, and partly this has been because of the discovery in 1945 of the so-called Nag Hammadi Library, which is nothing other than a collection of many original Gnostic texts. And here is the Nag Hammadi Library, which was discovered in 1945, but was it only found its way into translation relatively recently. So I presume that copies of this book are in the bookstore. If not, you can certainly order it if you want to order it after this rendition. So the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Library in 1945 was one of those fortunate accidents that an Egyptian peasant had seen and rummaging around in an obscure cave or something of that sort, stumbled across these ancient texts and took them home, and he sort of unwittingly destroyed a number of them, but before they finally received notice from scholars who succeeded in prying them away. And they were written, for the most part, in Coptic. Coptic is the old Egyptian language, written in an alphabet adapted to the Greek alphabet. In certain portions of Egypt, they still speak Coptic. There are certain Christian churches in Egypt and in Cairo, which are Coptic Christian churches. But it's a rare person nowadays who can speak Coptic, and it's a language that really is accessible only to highly specialized scholars. So it was up to these highly specialized scholars to translate these documents for us, and it took quite a while to do that, partly because scholars squabble endlessly over who's going to get the rights to do what. But finally, enough of the squabbling was successfully resolved, and the book that you see here is the result of some very excellent scholarly work, which has produced these documents for us. Time permitting, this afternoon I will read you some of the translations of certain of these books so you can kind of get the flavor of the thinking of these people. Now, before the discovery of the Nag Hammadi documents, there were only scanty original documents of Gnostic writings that were available to us. There was one collection called the Pistis Sophia, collected together and edited by the scholar G.R.S. Mead. That's also available. But other than that, there was practically nothing left of the original Gnostic writings. So how do we know about what the Gnostics taught? Well, the answer is that we knew it as much as was available to us from the writings of the early church fathers. Now, the early church fathers, for those of you who may not be familiar with this, were those original thinkers, if you like, in the early Christian church for about the first four centuries after the time of Christ. And these people were, well, they were sort of philosophers, theologians, and psychologists all rolled up into one bag. They weren't exactly just theologians, they were also philosophers, and they were also, to a remarkable degree, psychologists. Some of them were more heavily on the psychological side, and some more heavily on the philosophical, and some on the theological. But in those days, they didn't make a distinction amongst those fields. Theology, philosophy, psychology was all part of one package. The names of most of these early church fathers are not familiar to persons who haven't studied church history or immersed themselves in such ancient lore as we're considering. But just to mention a few of them, we had Clement of Alexandria. There was a very famous school, a Christian school in Alexandria in Egypt, where Christian teaching and intellectual life and development really reached its height. And the first great Christian philosopher there was Clement of Alexandria. And then he was succeeded by perhaps the most brilliant mind in that early part of the time, Origen. And after Origen came Gregory of Thaumaturgus. And so this was a great center of learning. In fact, it remained a great center of learning in the ancient world until the 7th century, when the Muslims took over Egypt. And then somebody burned the famous library at Alexandria, one of the great tragic losses of ancient time. There was, of course, no way of reprinting books, and so all the manuscripts were copied very slowly. And they were kept in these libraries where the scholars could go and find them. But somebody, nobody quite knows who, torched the library, and a treasure house of centuries of ancient works were consumed forever. Probably we would have known a lot more about such ancient Greek philosophers as Thales and Heraclitus if that fire had not happened. Well, I'm sort of digressing just a little bit, but helps to get into the flavor of this era. Now, for our purposes, the primary persons who wrote about Gnosticism among the early church fathers were these, a gentleman called Irenaeus, A-R-E-N-A-E-U-S, in case you are interested in such details, and his disciple Hippolytus, H-I-P-P-O-L-Y-T-U-S, and another scholar, another early Christian thinker from the Latin church. He lived in Carthage. All North Africa was heavily Christian at that time, you know, by the name of Tertullian, T-E-R-T-U-L-L-I-A-N. There were others who said, had some records of them too, but these were the primary persons. And so they in a good deal of detail, great detail as a matter of fact, explained in their books what the Gnostics believed in. Now, the church fathers, however, were hostile to the teachings of the Gnostics. The church fathers and the Gnostics were adversaries in the theological and the philosophical world. And so what we have then is the fact that until the discovery of the Nag Hammadi library in 1945 is the fact that the only way we knew what the Gnostics thought was what we were told about them by their enemies. So naturally, one was suspect that what Irenaeus and Hippolytus and Tertullian and others said about the Gnostics might not be so accurate. And in fact, they have been accused of not having been accurate by such persons as Elaine Pagels. So it was with a good deal of interest that, knowing this, that I read the Nag Hammadi library for myself. And I must say, while trying to be objective, what I was surprised at was how accurate they were. I can't find any serious things that the early church fathers represented about the Gnostics, which one does not find amply represented in the Nag Hammadi library itself. What we do find, of course, is that the early church fathers, while they might arguably have presented Gnostic teachings objectively, certainly presented them with a negative byline comment. And that's what we're going to try to avoid doing today. Now, Gnosticism, by the way, the word Gnosticism derives from one of the Greek words for knowledge, gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S. Now, the Greeks, as one might suspect, had innumerable words for knowledge. And each one of the different Greek words for knowledge represented a certain different nuance of knowledge, a different kind of knowledge. They made a very careful distinction between the ways one arrived at knowledge. Now, the word gnosis, for that kind of knowledge, or the verbal form of gnosis, which was the Greek word gnosko, referred to knowledge which came from interior experience, specifically. Now, for instance, when we read in the Gospels that the infant Jesus was born, the text adds that Joseph had not yet known Mary, meaning he had not had sexual intercourse with Mary before, and that she conceived nonetheless. And the word for known is this word gnosko, or gnosis. The idea being that to have sexual intercourse with someone was to enter into an intimate knowledge of that person. And the same is said also of Mary in the Gospels. The same thing is true in the Hebrew text. I don't know Hebrew, but I have been assured by persons who do that when the book of Genesis says that Adam and Eve had not yet known each other sexually, that a Hebrew word very similar to gnosko is used. And in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation, an ancient Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, the word gnosko is used. And that gives you a little bit of the flavor. All right, any kind of mystical knowledge would be gnosis. Or any kind of, like I say, any kind of knowledge that required the interior experience of something. So the word gnosis was a very important word in ancient times. And because, as we will see, Gnosticism hinges upon the idea of a revealed knowledge, that word has been adapted to refer to this particular school of thought. However, it would be a mistake to suppose that the word gnosis or Gnosticism was reserved by the Gnostics for their own use. It's a very important biblical word, too. And one finds the verbal form and the noun form occurring over and over again in the New Testament, and I would imagine the equivalent Hebrew form in the Old Testament. In the Gospel of John, one finds the word gnosis or gnosko is used approximately 118 times. And the word, no, beg pardon, about 95 times. And the word for faith, approximately 118 times. I think that's the count that I got when I counted them all up. So it's the word is a very important word, but it's not the exclusive property of the Gnostic movement. Now, Gnosticism was as a movement, that is a philosophical, theological movements which taught how there is a secret revealed knowledge which one must learn in order to achieve salvation. That would be a rough definition of Gnosticism in its broadest sense. A secret revealed knowledge which must be learned in order to achieve salvation. As a movement, Gnosticism can be said to exist, have existed and flourished in about the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries of our era. What its earliest antecedents are, we really don't know. Now, Gnosticism is not to be identified with Christianity or a Christian movement. It existed side by side with Christianity. One reason the two were such rivals is that Christianity was growing and flourishing at the same time that Gnosticism was growing and flourishing, and they competed to a great extent to win over the same people. The same people were competed for by both systems of thought. So it was never identical with Christianity, but it was often, in many of its expressions, Gnosticism was often highly influenced by Christianity. And there were some Gnostic thinkers who attempted to appropriate Christian ideas into their own Gnostic systems. Or one could put it the other way around, and one could say that there were certain Christians who espoused a belief in Christ who attempted to use Gnostic ideas and perspectives to further explain the mysteries of Christ. At any rate, it so happened that when Gnostic ideas conjoined with Christian ideas, that there emerged what we could now call a Gnostic Christianity, or a Christian Gnosis. So, but there were also Gnostic forms of Gnosis, which had made no attempt to assimilate Christians' ideas at all. So Gnosticism was a broader and a separate movement for Christianity. But in certain instances, it attempted to incorporate Christianity also. Now, while there were certain common features to Gnosticism, its revealed knowledge and so forth, there was never any official Gnostic doctrine. And so one really finds as many variations of Gnosticism as there were Gnostic teachers. Now, one can find similarities. That's why we call them all Gnostic. But the details of their teachings, and often many of the main features of their teachings, could be markedly different. As a movement, a religious and philosophical movement, Gnosticism appears to have vanished about the 5th century. We're not quite sure. Either it lost its momentum, or, as some of its proponents claim, it may have been persecuted from existence by the Christians. Now, that is sometimes alleged that the Christians persecuted the Gnostics. I don't think that could have occurred before 323 B.C., because the Christians had no state power with which to persecute anybody. Instead, they were being persecuted. But in the year 323 B.C., you may remember, a great catastrophe happened to Christianity from which it has never, ever since recovered. The Emperor Constantine became a Christian, and he made Christianity the state religion. His motive seemed to have been more political than religious, although he was baptized and so forth and so on. Well, he didn't get baptized till he was on his deathbed. I think he wanted to save it till the very end because he had so many sins he wanted to go to heaven forgiven for them. But at any rate, he made Christianity a state religion. So almost overnight, Christianity came from being a persecuted group to being the religious group that was in a position of power. And with that, there entered a great deal of deviltry. And so from then on, the Christian church was capable of persecuting its adversaries, and it did so. Usually, the main objects of persecution were that dissenting Christians were persecuted from other Christians who happened to be in power at the time. But the pagans came in for a share of persecution too, and it may well have been that this also happened to the Gnostics, although as far as I can tell, we have no explicit recorded historical record to that effect. Like I say, Christianity has never been the same since. It was most unfortunate that it took place. Now, Christianity is often, and Gnosticism are often contrasted with each other. They were inevitable rivals because they dealt with the same issues. And they dealt with the same issues in ways that were, in certain respects, quite alike. But in certain other very important respects, were quite different. So they were competing over the same things. It'd be like, it's not a very good analogy, but if you had two dogs and they're both after the same piece of steak, why, you might get a little enmity, you know. So they were rivals. They were dealing with the same questions. The nature of God, the problem of evil, the nature of the soul, and methods of salvation. It might, however, be too great a tendency from our perspective to read back into the Christian Gnostic controversy the amount of antagonism that some commentators on the subject seem to read back. I have an idea that probably the Christian Gnostic controversy was as heated, but no more heated, than the Freudian-Jungian controversy in the early part of this century. Now, as you will recall, that was considerable. And Jung and the Jungians were expelled from the Freudians, and there was a good deal of antipathy, etc., etc., etc. And even to this day, it isn't quite healed. The Freudians all now seem to be becoming Jungians, but they refuse to concede it. And calling the Jungian ideas by different concepts and one thing and another. But we Jungians just sit back smugly and look at them going through this parade. But as you all know, there was a great deal of hostility between Freud and Jung and the Freudians and the Jungians, and there were many accusations back and forth, etc., etc., etc. Nobody was put to the stake or torched, but there might have been if somebody had the power. And I fancy that the Gnostic-Christian hostility was probably analogous to that. In the world of ideas, men and sometimes women, women less than men because women have more sense than men do, were perfectly willing to cross swords with each other in the most militant fashion. And things were no different in that era and in that respect in past times than they are in the present era. All right, so here are the questions that the Gnostics tried to answer. What is the nature of God? What is the relationship between God and the created world? What is the origin of evil? What is the nature of the human soul? How can the soul escape from a world of evil or from its evil condition? That is to say, how is the soul saved, if it is saved at all? And for the Christian Gnostics and for the Christians, what is the relationship of Christ to this process of salvation? Those were the primary questions with which the Gnostics were wrestling. They are the same questions with which the Christians were wrestling, and they are the same questions with which we're wrestling. The ancient questions people have had to ask themselves. Now I'm going to give you the Gnostic scheme of things, summarize it for you, according to the Gnostic teacher Valentinus, V-A-L-E-N-T-I-N-U-S. Well, I guess I've written that down in the handout. Now, Valentinus was probably the best known and the most famous of the Christian Gnostics. We don't know a great deal about him, but we know more about Valentinus than we do about other Gnostic teachers. Although what we know, we've been given by the Church Fathers. But apparently he was the foremost of the Gnostic teachers during the era in which he lived, which would have been about the 3rd century, maybe a little earlier than the 3rd century, 2nd century perhaps. It is said that he originally taught in Alexandria, which is where, as I mentioned, all the great scholars and thinkers taught if they could. But later he went to Rome, which is becoming another center of influence and of learning, where he established his own school and where he participated in the local Roman Christian church or congregation. However, as it turned out, and his teachings were recognized to vary from what the members of that congregation regard as the true Christian teachings, he was asked to leave, and so he did. But he continued to teach there in Rome, and Valentinus tells us that, so we are told by the early church fathers, that Valentinus received his gnosis in a vision, and in the vision, a newly born child appeared in the vision and taught Valentinus these things, which I'm now going to summarize for you, a la our friend Irenaeus, who brings us most of this information with certain additions from Hippolytus and occasionally Tertullian. So it runs like this. And now I'm going over the material in our handout here. Originally, there was Boothus, a Greek word that means the depth. This was the pre-existent one. That is to say, this is the one who existed before there was anything existing, before there was any created order. He was invisible. He was incomprehensible. Pure spirit and pure light. He was known as the first ion. The word ion here is a very important word in Gnosticism, as it is in all ancient philosophy and in Christian lore also. It's a hard word to render into English. The word in Greek literally means an age. an age of time. Here it's kind of hypostasized as a, you might say, an ion is a certain divinity. And yet it's not quite like a god because it doesn't exactly have personality like one of the Greek gods. It's an ion. He was known as the first father. Now, the Boothos is analogous to what in Christian theology, in John's Gospel, for instance, would be meant by the Father. John's Gospel, you may remember, says, Jesus in John's Gospel says, no one has known the Father. It's an idea we find in mystical theology of all sorts, that there is a dimension to God that is unknowable, ineffable, unthinkable, a dimension in God where the categories of time do not apply. We cannot say even that he endures forever. He's beyond time. God existed in this dimension before there was such a thing as time. All mystical theology that I know of, at least, gets into this understanding, and Gnosticism is no exception. Therefore, it is not necessary to explain how Boothos came into being. He always was. In fact, even the category of existence, as we understand it, does not apply to this ion. It's a bit like the idea of Brahman in Hindu Oriental thought. In fact, some people think that Gnosticism was influenced by Eastern philosophical thought. Then existing in him, with him as his female counterpart was Sige. That's a Greek word that means silence. Now, there are all of these ions have more than one name. I'm not going to complicate it right now by giving you all the names. In my outline here that you've got, you'll see some of the alternative names are there. So now we have from the one, we now have these two. And Sige, there are different renderings of the particulars of the relationship between Sige and Boothos. But following this particular scheme of things, Sige existed within Boothos as a seed in a womb. And so out from the union of those two emerged nous. And nous is a Greek word that means sort of mind. Nous had other names, which I will repeat. Monogenes, which means the only begotten. He was also called Father. He was also called the beginning of all things. And united with him was aletheia, a Greek word meaning truth. So this became another syzygy of opposites, a masculo-feminine pair. This formed the first tetrad, the first four ions. It's the first four holy, awesome tetrad. From this first tetrad, there emerged four other ions bearing the names of Logos, which means word with a capital W, and Zoe, which means life as the principle of life, Anthropos, meaning man in the generic sense, for both sexes, not man as male, but humankind. And ecclesia, meaning church. And so these latter four ions formed in turn the sacred ogdoad, the sacred eight. Now, you say, well, what's all this sacred tetrad and this sacred ogdoad? Why does Sanford pull all that in? Because that's the way they talked. Numbers had mystical significance. They were not just, they had much more than arithmetical properties. In the ancient world, beginning with Pythagoras, who did so much to discover the arithmetical meaning of numbers, numbers resonated with mystical power. The ancient mind was awestruck by numbers and their power and their relevance. So the Holy Tetrad has a numinous, awesome quality to it. It isn't just saying there were four of them. You have to kind of get back into a different mindset. Now, emanating from the eight ions forming the sacred Ogdoad came the mixture of five more pairs that you see there in your handout. So I need not read all of those names. So these 10 ions form the decad, the number 10. Then there come 12 more. Oh, now let's see. I always get confused with this. It's very confusing. All right, we have those 10 ions. Yeah, then we have the 8. Yeah, so we have 18 ions up above. Okay, we've got 18 ions so far, if you're counting, which I'm trying to do. Now we have 12 more, which you also see listed there on your handout, with all of those names, all of which have a particular meaning in the Greek. And this forms 30 ions, another sacred number. And you'll be glad to know that's all there are. It's already confusing enough. So now we have the 30 ions arranged in syzygies, masculo-feminine pairs. These 30 ions make up the pleroma. Now, the pleroma is a Greek word which means the fullness or the all. The pleroma is the full completeness of something. So the pleroma, the 30 ions, makes up the totality of anything that is. Now, this is a divine spiritual world. It is pure light, and it is pure spirit. Now, at this point, another entity emerges, somewhat a little bit later in the cosmology, called Horos, H-O-R-O-S, a Greek word which means limit. And Horus is very important in certain Gnostic cosmologies because Horus is the establisher of limits. You remember Themis last night was the establisher of boundaries and limits. Well, this is sort of another version of Themis, but much more important spiritual reality. So Horus established a limit to the pleroma beyond which there was nothing. More about Horus a little bit later on. A way to remember Horus is to remember our word horizon, which derives from the Greek word horos. The horizon is the limit to which you can see. That's the horizon. Interesting how these words find their way into our vocabulary. Now, so far so good. There's no evil, there's no darkness, there's no matter, there's no sin, there's no suffering. There's simply the always existing purely spiritual, purely light world of the reality of the ions. Everything is just fine. Well, as you and I know, everything isn't just fine. And the Gnostics knew everything wasn't just fine, too. So the great question came, how from this magnificent beginning did this world in which you and I come into existence where things are far from fine? Were these ions seen as having personalities, or were they forces? It looks a little like they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. Because one gets the impression very often that they are forces, but then when descriptions are made about what happens, it sounds for all the world like they have personalities. When we read some of these texts this afternoon, you try to get a feeling for yourself about that very good question. Any other questions before we get on to the hard stuff here about the fall? I wasn't planning to, but I... All right. One, it was the word episteme. Episteme, that was would correspond to scientific knowledge. We get our word epistemology from that word. That would be a good example, episteme. And right at the moment, some of the other ones have slipped my mind, but I'll come up with them after lunch if I can. That's right, indirect knowledge, by observation. So you observe how things are, and that gives you a scientific understanding, but it's not experiential, it's not mystical. No, nothing like, there's nothing analogous in Gnosticism to stories like the Greek gods. They don't have personalities like that. You'll see shortly how they have personalities, because I'm going to tell you about that. Mm-hmm. Well, they come from the ones before. The first pairs of opposites, out of their union, give birth to the next, and so it goes on down the line. Until we get to 30, then Horus draws the limit, and there are no more. That's the complete number. No, not really. No, the word, the Christians didn't take the episteme approach versus the gnosis approach. The Christians were as much relieved that their knowledge was a gnosis, too. That's why, as I mentioned, John's Gospel has the word gnosis in it so much, and so do the other Gospels. The word episteme, I'm not sure if it even occurs in the New Testament. It is now, but it wasn't originally. You see, what happened with the church was that originally the knowledge of God and the knowledge of the Christian tenets were regarded as being matters of gnosis too. And so in the original Christian church, they were open to all kinds of interior experience. They were open to dreams, they were open to visions. That's why they were very psychological. And it was later, as the church entered into the power structure, especially after 323, when they entered into the power structure and power got into it, then the matters of correct doctrine became more important to those in the power than matters of direct experience. And that's where Christianity tended to lose its experiential quality and to be replaced by creedal formulations, which were regarded as either correct or as heretical. But originally, that was not characteristic of Christianity. There's kind of a lost era of Christianity. Those first two or three centuries are kind of unknown to us because it was so different at that time. Hard to believe now. Some people have said of the fourth gospel, because of its mystical quality, some people have said that that's the Gnostic gospel. It isn't the Gnostic gospel. Christianity was a Gnostic religion. That's why it's there. And as I mentioned, these first Christian fathers, there are recognizable similarities in all of the Gnostic schemes. Many of them closely resembled each other, and, like I say, recognizable similarities occurred. But this particular scheme is representative of an important one, but it's not completely representative of all of them. In our readings, we'll get into some of the divergent ones. This is the only one I can talk about in a whole lot of detail because, number one, it's basically the important one that was meticulously summarized in the ancient literature. And while I've been able to present this to you in a reasonably orderly fashion, it took me a hell of a long while to figure it out. You read those ancient texts and you get so confused. Mm-hmm. How do we know what the Christians believed before? Well, we know that because of the writings of the early church fathers. Oh, from the very beginning. One finds the earliest ones writing contemporaneously with some of the later gospels. Yes. Oh, and what documents were lost there? What? Mm-hmm. Right. You mean perhaps there were important documents that were lost in that fire that we don't know about? Well, it's not likely that important Christian documents were lost in that fire because if there had been important, they would probably have been mentioned in the surviving literature. Well, that unregrettable tendency didn't surface until they got the power to do so.
Right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Well, you see, the early Christian documents were, like these men like Tertullian and Hippolytus and Irenaeus and so forth, were pretty widely circulated. So there would have been scrolls of those documents in various places throughout the ancient world. The documents that might have perished for all time in the fire in Alexandria would have been rarer documents that were no longer so widely disseminated and copied. And so I doubt if there's much Christian literature that was permanently lost in that fire. Another great fire that was very destructive to ancient learning occurred in the year 1204 when so-called Christian crusaders sent by Western Christianity and the Pope in Rome came down through Byzantium, which is now Turkey, you know, and through the Near East, ostensibly to drive the infidels, the Muslims, out of the Holy Land. But they stopped on their way, and they sacked Constantinople, the ancient city of Byzantium, which was the center of learning that had replaced Alexandria. And they put the city to the torch. It was a Christian city, but it represented Eastern Christianity, not Western. They put it to the torch. And a vast library was destroyed there. And scholars also speculate what ancient documents, maybe even some of these Gnostic documents, might have been destroyed in that fire, as well as the fire of Alexandria. See, back in these days, you know, all books were meticulously copied by hand. They had no form of printing. And so it was hard to get these books. They were perishable. And these centers of learning were there, where scholars could go and read these scrolls. And so the destruction of Constantinople in 1204 by the Crusaders was a disaster for learning. Yeah, Alexandria was in the 7th century. I've forgotten the exact date, 622 or something like that. All right, let's have our lunch, and we'll meet at about 1:15, buddy. Gather together. All right, now I might make one quick comment, and then we'll have a questions and discussion. That it's controversy with the Gnostics was carried on not only by the Christians and by some Jews, but also by Platonic Greek philosophers. That's much less well known, but the Neo-Platonic philosopher Plotinus also objected to Gnosticism on some of the same grounds as did the Christians. And if anybody's interested in that rather obscure piece of knowledge, it's in the second Aeneid of Plotinus, 9:5 and 9:16. He objected to the idea of the elect and of the denigration of the material world. All right, I want to save some time to say some more about why Jung valued Gnosticism as much as he did. But let's go on first to your questions and discussion. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, well, the question is, I said that we were going to look at the Gnostic idea of salvation. And the point is raised here, well, what was there to be saved from if sin and evil were not the major problem? Well, the thing to be saved from was being caught and contained in the material realm. That was what the Gnostics saw was the need for salvation. When the souls of the elect needed to be saved from being caught in material reality. And unless they were saved, they would endlessly come back again and again. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is the church returning to its Gnostic roots? First, let me qualify a little bit when I said that in the early church that there was a Gnostic church, depending on interior experience. It depended, see, on who you were listening to in the early church. In other words, what we had in the early church were the formation of congregations, which was would be analogous to the Jewish formation of congregations. Now, it would be too much to expect all of these members of these congregations, some of whom were soldiers in the army and others were carpenters and artisans and so forth and so on, or women with their tasks and their families and so forth, to become experts in the matters of religion. And so there were many, let's say, quote-unquote, plain people who became Christians and looked to certain persons to be their mentors and their guides in spiritual matters. So I'm not trying to say that everybody who turned up a Christian was this enlightened seeker after the deep things. But in the early Christian church, there were those people who did. And the spirit, the ethos of the church, promoted that until those conditions that I brought to your attention. Okay, now let's see. The second part of the question was, remind me and jog my memory. You were asking about, the church today. Oh, today. No, I don't. I see the church today as having unfortunately lost its interest in religious experience. Now, sometimes, at its best, I think the church can be some churches can create a climate favorable to that exploration if they want to. The Roman Catholic Church, I see, is really split in this regard. On the one hand, nothing can be as narrow and as patriarchal in the bad sense of the word and as regimented and doctrinaire as the Roman Catholic Church. At the same time, the Roman Catholic Church has always maintained its mystical dimension. It has another life, a subterranean life, and that still goes on, and which accounts for the peculiarity that a lot of my books are published by a Roman Catholic press. So there is that. In a church like my own church, the Episcopal Church, is a very open-minded church. One can be all kinds of things, you see. The danger with the Episcopal Church is that I'm not sure whether it's open-minded or empty-minded. So, no, I don't see any area, unless it would be the Quakers, the Friends, and in many cases it's hostile to it. I see fundamentalism is extremely hostile to it, terrified. Anything that they don't understand is of the devil, and since that includes almost everything, why... Now, to be frank about my own experience, I had, for 19 years, I had Episcopalian parishes, and my father was an Episcopal minister, and all my ancestors for hundreds of generations back, and all that sort of thing. And so I had a pleasant upbringing in the Episcopal Church. It was a nice church, and people were nice to me, and it wasn't a bad place to be. And so I don't have any horror stories to tell, and I was a pretty good Episcopalian priest. But, of course, I was smitten by these ideas. So I would, but I found it very natural to interpret large bodies of the Scripture along these ways. You know, you can see in the story of Jacob and the story of Joseph, wonderful stories of the individuation process. I mean, just marvelous. All the essential things are there. And they're very numinous stories. So I would kind of teach along that line. I was very tactful. But eventually people kind of got a whiff of what was going on. So... In both the two churches I had, I was successful. We had fundraising drives. We paid off the debt before I left. The congregations, if they didn't multiply by four or five times, at least they did well. But in both cases, after I left, it became apparent through what was obvious and through the spy system that both churches were bound to determine never to have anybody like me again. And that's what they did. They set out to get somebody who wasn't ever like me. The bad side of me took a sinful delight in the fact that my immediate predecessors at both churches were total failures. In every respect, I thought that's what they deserved. But that's just my bad side. My good side said that's too bad and was glad when the next clergy were more or less competent people. But that, I think that's kind of where the church is. I don't think the church is... In some churches, you could develop your interior life along these lines, and it would be okay. And it might even be nourishing in certain traditions. I suspect in the Orthodox traditions it would be more nourishing. The Orthodox traditions still believe in the ancient early Christian doctrine of deification. We don't hear about that in the Western churches. It's very important in the early church. And the idea was that the point of the Christian life was to become transformed into God, into the likeness of God. And it was a very important teaching, in the Greek called theosis, roughly translated as deification, and that doctrine is still the major doctrine in the Orthodox communions to this day. Honest to goodness, some of what passes for Christianity today is just repugnant to me personally. All right, the interesting point is made that probably Gnosticism appealed most to intuitive thinking type of people. I would think that probably would be so. I think that probably most of the early church theologians were also intuitive thinking types of people. Now the question is, what about sensation types? How did they find an interior life? Gosh, I'm so far from being a sensation type that I don't know. Is there a sensation type here? No, and they will admit to it. But I don't doubt that there is a way, and it might have to do with the possibly, I'm just guessing now, but something to do with the contemplation of the created order. See, that was always an ancient way of knowing God. You could know God through interior experience, but you could also know God by observing God's handiwork. And God's handiwork, the creative power, was evidence in all of the created order. We find this in the Old Testament. We find it in the New Testament and in most of the early fathers. So it could be that it would be in that. But that's a good question, which means, like I said, you have a bad answer. Betty? That's a good point. I like that. It may well be that it's the ritual that provides it. I have observed that a psychologist friend of mine led a clergy conference and gave them all the Myers-Briggs, and I was amazed at how many of them turned out to be sensation types. I think about 28%, he told me, were sensation types. And I think you're probably right. And for them, the ritual can be very, very numinous. Now, as an intuitive type, that's my main function. That was one of the great difficulties I had being a clergy person. I was not interested in rituals. What I had to do because it was my job, but I was just not very interested in it, and got kind of bored with it. The only rituals, oddly enough, that I found religiously meaningful were funerals. In funerals, everybody was very solemn. There's the numinous grasped everybody, no matter who they were. There was none of this fooling around. The least religious ceremonies were weddings. Huge egocentric displays, mostly for the benefit of the. I never want another wedding. I'm free of all that now. Isn't that nice? Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it does. It does sound like it's not so much interior, but external and matter of doctrine. Now, I have attempted to be really objective about this matter, and I've got over having to have any axes to grind as to who's right and who's wrong. But you might want to compensate my presentation by reading some of the zealous proponents of Gnosticism. And the most zealous one I can think of is Stephen Heller. I think his book is over there, The Gnostic Jung, I believe it's called. And Elaine Pagels is also pretty zealous, although she mostly goes into an argument about church politics and so forth, and which has a lot of merit. But it doesn't really get into these roots of things here. And then I noticed I picked out four books over there I didn't even know existed. And you should probably supplement my presentation with this other reading just to make sure that without unintentionally I've overlooked things. But I don't think I have. Oh, the Gnostics had their rituals too. Oh, yes, they definitely had their rituals. They would meet as congregations and they had their rituals. We don't know nearly as much about just exactly what they did. But they had their rituals and their sermons and their teachers and things like that. Did they relate to their numerology to become complete people? Possibly. But you need to understand that numerology was widespread in the ancient world. And the early Christians were also numerologists. Now, this may surprise you, but an early Christian hermeneutic, which is the method of interpreting the Bible, amongst these early fathers whom I had mentioned, every number in the Bible, in addition to its literal arithmetical significance, had a mystical meaning. Every number. That's the way that they saw things. Numbers were not just arithmetical realities. And so in the early Christian hermeneutic, there was the Bible is interpreted on three levels: the historical level, so the story of Joshua at the Battle of Jericho was history, or the event in the Christian cycle would be history, its ethical import, and its mystical meaning. And what they call the mystical meaning is what we would call the psychological meaning, the interior meaning. And that was the method of early biblical interpretation for centuries. All of that method of interpreting the Bible is gone. See, what I was essentially trying to do in my church was to bring that method back. And that's what I see as having basically been rejected, although not rejected. I mean, many of the people who heard the kind of thing I talked about were very happy to get it. It's just that they were sort of a minority. So all of the parables of the Bible and all of the everything in the Bible that happened would be interpreted with the interior spiritual mystical dimension by persons like Irenaeus and Origen and Clement of Alexandria and these others whom I mentioned. It's quite fascinating what they would do with it. And the numbers especially. So they had a field day with John 21, because in John 21 we're told that Jesus, he comes back, you know. He was risen, but according to that chapter, he came back for one last meeting with the disciples. And the disciples, not knowing it was Jesus, on the shore, were out there fishing, and they couldn't catch any fish. And so he told them to throw their nets on the other side. And they brought back 153 fish, neither more nor less. So the ancient biblical interpreters had a marvelous time with that number, 153. Why was it 153? Well, obviously, it was there for a spiritual significance. And they would try to get to the bottom of that with their numerology. So numerology was very important for the Gnostics, but it was equally important for the Christians. The number 12. It was no accident there were 12 tribes of Israel and 12 apostles, because 12 was a sacred number. And the number 10 was a sacred number, and the number 3, and so forth. All of these numbers were sacred. They had their personalities, and that was sacred. Is there a book on numerology along this line? Unfortunately, there's not. As far as I know, there isn't. I thought of writing one. I should write one. You know? At least write an article on it. I've got the material. I've got lots of references to ancient numerology in my files and things like that. Well, I don't know if it's like the present books on numerology, because I don't bother to pay any attention to them, but it might be. The Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical book, I think that the numerology that came up in the early Christian church would be very much like that of the Kabbalah. Very much. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, something like that. That up until the period of time that the interior, the mystical, experiential learning prevailed in the Christian church, and then it vanished. Now, it never vanished completely. It went underground. So, as with the Roman church, for instance, we find that very strict doctrinaire, rigid position, but then we also find the flourishing of mysticism during the medieval years of Roman Catholicism and the great mystical persons, many of whom were women, emerging. So there was always that tendency always was there, but it became very submerged, and its final formulations had to fit into the right doctrine and teaching. Why that happened? Well, not a very adequate one, but of course it had to do with the organization and with power. And there I think Elaine Pagels makes some very good points. As you organize and as you have power and wealth, then control becomes very important. And the ability to have sort of a free personal experience becomes diminished. Yes, it would come up in other arenas. And Jung says it came up in alchemy. He says that the lost mystical tradition came up in alchemy. And that light's right in my eyes. It's got, oh, I can move this over, either that or the curtain. Okay. Let me just pull this over a little bit. That probably is enough. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, Jung says that it came up in alchemy. That's one of the points we're gonna get to a little later. All right, how about the Muslims, and why did they destroy the library in Alexandria, if they did? Now, nobody's ever confessed. Because the Christians think that they did, but the Muslims deny it. Well, I'm not a great expert on Islam, but as I understand it, the attitude in Islam is that anything that's worth knowing is in the Quran. Literally, everything is in the Quran that's worth knowing. And therefore, while they do theoretically honor the Jewish scripture and the Christian scripture, and they regard that as sacred, still the basic holy text from which the saving knowledge comes is the Quran. So if it's not in the Quran, not only is it worthless, but it shouldn't exist. Now, I'm sure there are different gradations of the intensity of this belief. But it's equally prevalent now. And so that would be a sufficient reason for the Islam coming into what once North Africa, as I mentioned, was all a very Christian area. And so the Arabs come in, the now Islamic Arabs, and they control this area. And given that belief and their need to control, it would not be surprising had they burned down the library. That's right. In the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. That's right. During the European Dark Ages, when everything in Europe and in Christendom collapsed and fell to a very, very dark level, Islamic situation reached its very heights. And they were the retainers of a considerable and sophisticated knowledge during those centuries. And eventually a lot of that knowledge came back into Europe to revitalize European learning. But there were also, that would be the sophisticated Islamic. The more zealous fundamentalist side would be capable of that, as would zealous fundamentalists in every religion. I'm not singling the Islamic people out for their any corner on that. So if I'm glad there's no microphone around here. If the fundamentalists in this country were to say to gain political control, I mean, God knows what we would see. Well, let's back up a little bit. The question is about the parables and whether we don't find in the parable and the Bible that they were regarded as having an inner esoteric meaning open to only the few, right? Yes, right. And whether that same attitude was in the Gnostics, right, so that they felt that they had the privileged interpretation of certain things. Yeah. Well, yes, we hear frequently in the Bible the words, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Now, the significance of that seems to be that in the ancient mind, it was believed that the soul had senses as well as the body. The soul had a sense of smell and taste and sight and hearing. So there was interior hearing, which we would call today insight. And that interior hearing could never be given directly. One could extract from one's interior hearing a certain doctrine and hand it down. But the faculty to hear with the ears of the soul cannot be, it has to come about. So that's the same thing as we find in the practice of analysis. When we're the analyzon in analysis, or anybody who's working analytically with themselves, whether they're in analysis or not, it's a matter of suddenly getting it, of a click, you know. Now I get the dream. Now I suddenly hear what that dream is saying to me. It falls into place. And unless that happens, the best explanation is of no avail. And if someone has not the ears to hear, then none of this will penetrate. Their ears are, the Bible would call them, that they have, would say they have become hard of heart. And so they don't hear anything. And I think that that's what those allusions to the parables mean. Yes, Jesus can teach the parables, but only if you have ears to hear will you really hear. All right, now we come to the mystery religions.
Right.
And the mystery religions were very prevalent in the ancient world. They're especially prevalent in Greece, but they spread all over the ancient world. Now, that's very interesting, the mystery religions, because the Greek word that is involved here is a word, it's the word musterion. I'll spell it for you in English. M-U-S-T-E-R-I-O-N. That's the Greek word, musterion. It's translated in English as a mystery. Now, that's unfortunate, because for us, a mystery is a puzzle to be solved. The Greek word doesn't mean that. The Greek word, it refers to a knowledge that can only be acquired through a personal initiatory experience of that knowledge. A personal initiatory experience is required for the knowledge of a musterion. So you can't go to school and get a musterion. So these mystery religions were religions in which there was a secret initiatory rite designed so that the initiate would acquire an insight into things which would have a highly redemptive effect. And probably the most important of those in the ancient world was the mystery religions at Eleusis in Greece, which were rites around the goddess Demeter. Now, most of these ancient mystery religions, there were carefully guarded secrets. The initiates into them had to undertake an oath of great secrecy that they would not reveal their contents. Well, that's nice. Thank you. So well kept were these secrets that to this day, scholars can hardly piece together what probably happened. Now, Christianity in its inception was a mystery religion in this sense of the word. It had its musterion. And the rites of the Eucharist were celebrated in that context, and they were not open to the profane. Now, that became lost as the church became successful. That was the trouble with Christianity. It became a success. Christianity is always terrible when it becomes a success. It's at its best when it's being persecuted. Then it gets down to its real business. So when it became a success, it lost that quality. Except, again, somewhat in the Eastern Orthodox churches, I think there's more of that aura, that feeling about it that has been retained. That help any? In revival of the, I don't think so. I think it's going to. Well, I think it's going to come about through a process akin to analysis. Yeah. Now I will say that I think that the experience in psychotherapy can quite enliven and bring back a belief in and a feeling of enrichment from one's religious tradition. And I don't think, from a religious tradition, and those religious traditions are very nourishing. I don't want to give you an idea that one should be down on that. They're tremendously nourishing once a person gets hooked up inside. But to get hooked up inside without the benefit of some kind of dream analysis, I think, I wouldn't want to say it's impossible, but it's just not what the church is doing now, with some rare exceptions. Yeah. Now, when a person does get into analysis, I personally, I don't know how other analysts work, I always try in a mild kind of a way to encourage that person's particular religious tradition. And so if they're Christian, I encourage them to reflect upon that in a new light. If they're Jewish, I keep quoting the Old Testament like crazy. I say, well, that sounds like Jacob wrestling with the angel, you know, and how he got his name changed. And generally speaking, why they don't know what I'm talking about. But and I've even made some forays into other religious traditions. Oh, yes, I had a Hindu once. And he was over in this country very westernized, and so he had his problems mostly with women. But he would have some dreams, and these dreams were fascinating. They're all about Hindu temples and this and that and the other, and I would try to interest him in those dreams because I was so interested in them. But he wanted nothing to do with that. He didn't want to get into his Hinduism. He didn't want to revive Hinduism. He wanted to find out how to get along with these women in America. Oh, for those? No, absolutely not. No, none at all. No meaning, none at all. And at death, mercifully, they perished, I believe. They didn't have to be endlessly reincarnated in a meaningless existence. After Sophia, the wisdom in the book of the wisdom figure in the book of Proverbs, and in the book of wisdom in the Old Testament, it's really fascinating reading to read about Sophia back in those wisdom books in the Old Testament. And that was wisdom. Wisdom in that strata of the Old Testament was hypostasized, was personified. And she was a function of God, the creative function of God. And they're beautiful passages. Now, in the early Christian church, it was said that Sophia, wisdom, was incarnated in Christ, that was wisdom coming back. So that in Christ was the Word and the wisdom of God. The Word being more the masculine, creative, world-creating aspect, and wisdom being the feminine, creative aspect. One being from a Greek tradition, the Word, and the other being from the Jewish tradition. And that's a dimension that is unfortunately entirely missing today. So Sophia was a very important aspect in early Christian thinking, especially in the Greek church. That is to say, all the Greek-speaking Christian church. See, we also need to remember that in early Christianity, the church originally was a Greek-speaking church. Then it spread all over the empire. And in the western part of the empire, they spoke largely Latin. In the eastern part of the empire, they spoke largely Greek. And the Latin Christians thought rather differently than the Greek Christians. They were much more legalistic. The Greek Christians, probably because of their language, remained much more mystical. And so especially in the Greek church, the whole importance of Sophia, as personified in the Old Testament and transposed into a Christian language, was very important. So that's who the cathedral in Sophia is named after. Pista Sophia would be the faith of Sophia. Right. And that's a Gnostic document. All that, right? And you can get that book. That book has been available now for quite a while. I forget when they found it. It was lurking around some library and somebody stumbled across it. It's been available, I think, for 100, 150 years. Pista Sophia. Oh, no, there's not much connection at all. No, the Gnostic Sophia and the Jewish Christian Sophia are related only by sharing the same name. In the Gnostic scheme of things, as you've seen, it was Sophia who was the unfortunate, or rather bumbling one, who was responsible for the fall. And that's no relationship at all to the Jewish Christian Sophia, who is the personification, essentially, of the whole creative aspect of God. And a remarkable inclusion of the feminine in God. There was much more of the feminine in God in both the Jewish tradition and the original Christian tradition than people surmise today. That's right. Yes, but that was all unfortunate. Now, the Gnostics, raises the interesting issue of the feminine in Gnosticism and in early Christianity. And Gnosticism had a reputation for giving a very important place in their assemblies to women. And apparently the women could be the teachers, and all the other functions that could be carried out by men could also be carried out by women. However, in their theological scheme, they did attribute to a feminine entity all these disasters. Now, in the early Christian churches, until it became so formalized, women were also very important. And they also did a great deal of the teaching and had a great, very high standing. In the New Testament, there's a remarkably high standard accorded to women, especially in contrast to the highly patriarchal society in which the church arose. And of course, in the Judeo-Christian aspect,
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.